this episode of the Press Rewind Prince Lyrics Podcast, Richard Cole and I are going to talk about the lyrics for the song off of Jill Jones' self-titled debut album. And that track was also included on the 2019 Originals release. And the song is Baby, You're a Trip and a Half. All right. So welcome back to the show, Richard.
Always glad to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to have you. Another St. Louis guy like I was for 7 years. Baby, You're a Trip, you know, Jill Jones. It's the only song that was included off of Originals from the Jill Jones album, which I guess makes sense. She only really had one, that one Paisley Park release, and Prince really only spent, besides some unreleased stuff that was going to be like on a second album, this was the one album that she worked on with Prince, and it took years. It was in the works for several years before it was finally released in 1987. And this song in particular, Baby, You're a Trip, dates back all the way to 1982. So a good 5 years before it finally saw the light of day as a Jill Jones release. What are your recollections of this song? Did you have any in real time, Richard, or was it more after the fact?
Yeah, you know, I was trying to find my cassette and I can't find it. It's in this house somewhere. It'll turn up.
Well, since you said cassette, I'm assuming that means... more real time.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, back then we're talking 87 and mm-hmm. CDs were like expensive, but at the time I bought Jill Jones, I didn't even have a CD player anyway, but cassette was kind of my main medium at Same. That time. Yeah, and it was me and a friend of mine, also a musician, we were in the record store and stumbled upon that, and yeah, we just had to pick it up because we were, you know, big Jill Jones fans from like the 1999 video. For me, even as far back as, you know, some of the Tina Marie albums, she sang background and co-wrote a couple of tracks.
Yeah. As a very young woman too, a young artist. She would have been really young back then.
Yeah, I think she was still like in high school. Mm-hmm. She was doing that with Tina Marie, yeah. But yeah, so when we saw that in the record store, it was like, yeah, this has to come home. And as far as like the music, and you know, this is that period, you know, we're just beginning to understand that Prince, you know, pretty much did virtually everything from the writing to the playing of the instruments. But for some reason we thought, or we felt that like Jill Jones had actually co-written some of those songs. So we were just like impressed off the lyrics. And this song, Baby Your Trip in particular, was one we really took notice of as far as the lyric content. Like, man, that's deep. But, you know, finding out that she didn't write that, Prince wrote all those lyrics, it was kind of like,
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, we look back and we all were fooled, right? We were all fooled. The Sheila E.'s albums were all written and produced by Sheila E. according to the lyric or to the liner notes. Same with the Vanity Six and Apollonia. Right. I mean, we're all fooled. So don't feel bad.
But yeah, like I said, that was one we really, really took notice of lyrically. And, you know, it's still one of my favorites. You know, finally hearing the original version with Prince vocals. I had like the bootleg for... I don't know, probably about 10 years, probably. And then to finally have an official release of it on the Originals album. Yeah, that was a bonus to have.
Yeah. So yeah, Baby You're a Trip is an important, although it was never released as a single by Jill, it was an important track on the album as it kind of bookends the entire record with her singing basically the first verse in the intro to Mia Bocca, and then and ends the same way. So you have that a cappella version of the song that ends the actual track that she sings at the beginning of Mia Bocca. Mm-hmm. So you get the bookend of the Baby You're a Trip, and for them to do that, for Prince and Jill to do that on her record, really kind of highlights the strength of the song, I think, and how important it was to showcase her vocal abilities and you know, and her ability to really sell a ballad.
Yes.
Which is what this is. Okay, so again, as I mentioned, Jill Jones, 87 release, Paisley Park, on the last track of the album, on the original's release, the only song that was released off of Jill Jones' album that was included on the original's. The version that was on original's is, I believe, it's the 82 version that was recorded at Sunset Sound. There we go. And Jill's vocals, her background vocals, are on the original's version too. So it's not just a solo Prince effort. He included Jill in singing background vocals on his version that, you know, he ultimately gave to her. And, you know, as the story has been related about this song, is supposedly the song was written about Jill. Prince thought she was a trip, you know. I mean, she has a strong personality. She was living with him at the time in 82 at the Kiowa Trail home when the song would have been written and recorded. There's the story about them sneaking peeks at each other's diaries. so that's behavior that I guess Prince kind of inspired the lyrics, or at least the title of the song, "Baby, You're a Trip." Like, you're crazy, girl, you're crazy. That kind of thing. But why? But obviously he had something for her. He felt a certain way about her and had romantic feelings for her. This was also around the time that he would have been writing "She's Always in My Hair" also, and kind of thinking like, Jill is really in it. You know, she's living with him, she's dating him, she's participating in recordings for the 1999 album. She's about to have a role in Purple Rain film that would be filmed the following year.
Right.
So this was about the time that she was closest to Prince, I would say. Which, I mean, do you agree with that sentiment?
Yeah. You know, even, you know, listening to her interviews, you know, just about that arrangement, you know, at that time you also had Vanity, who was a close, you know, I would say romantic, you know, romantic interest, as they say.
There's some lyrics later in the song that will point to Prince's inability to be monogamous, we'll just say.
Yeah. But I, you know, there's, like I said, interviews where, you know, she talks about that dynamic and how, you know, it's amazing they didn't all just gang up and hold them against the wall and go, you know,
pick one of us. You know, like, you have to stick with one of us, and you know,
yeah. Nowadays, nowadays that would make a very fascinating documentary. That would,
for sure,
wouldn't have gotten them in trouble, but you know, it wouldn't have been.
But I think that frames, even though Prince wrote it coming from Jill, like these lyrics being sung from Jill, it's almost like Prince knew that he had some sort of allure to her, or had some sort of, like, I don't know how to say it, like a pull when it comes to keeping her. Like, he felt like she was kind of attached to him in some way, or had some sort of attachment to him that she could not shake, even though he wasn't always probably the best boyfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we'll get to the lyrics and we'll kind of talk a little bit more about that.
Because definitely off and on. Yeah.
Yeah, off and on. Baby, you're a trip.
I know what people say. They say you don't know how to love. But I want you anyway. You're like a drug and I can't get enough. You be great in motion picture. Baby, you really got me blind. You're the only one I wanna see. You're the only one that does it to me every time.
The song starts off with, I know what people say. They say you don't know how to love, but I want you anyway. You're like a drug and I can't get enough. You'd be great in motion pictures, because baby, you really got me blind. You're the only one I wanna see. You're the only one that does it to me every time. So again, Prince wrote these lyrics, right? Mm-hmm. So, and he gave them to Jill to sing. Basically, here, sing these lyrics in a song that I wrote about me. Yeah. This is what I kind of get. Like, this is, you know, at least he was self-aware enough to kind of put these lyrics out there to be coming from Jill to be singing in essence about Prince, even though obviously by 1987 they weren't dating, so it could be about anybody. But in 1982, you know, he's saying like these, this is kind of like almost like autobiographical in some ways. If you're looking at it from that perspective in their relationship, they say you don't know how to love is a key line for me in this first verse, because it kind of tells me that this person that she's singing about is, you know, bewildered or just having some sort of difficult time with the emotional attachment she has to somebody who maybe she doesn't necessarily feel is returning that same level of emotion to her that she feels for him. And this, you know, this someone who doesn't really have the capacity in this person's mind to love others in a traditional way, you know, a little bit aloof, a little bit difficult to hold on to, difficult to grasp, because they're just, you know, like to use a cliche, like a rolling stone. They're just constantly moving, and it's hard to hold on to something and someone that's constantly moving, that's always in motion. And I don't know, that's that particular line really stands out to me in this first verse. What else do you see here, Richard?
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, isn't that, that's basically Prince, you know, given his upbringing, you know, broken home, you know, that can create trust issues or that kind of fear of commitment dynamic. Yeah, the fact that, yeah, she's singing a song he wrote for her, like you said, that's more about him. You know, that's kind of his music. Because, I mean, even if he was writing for the time, that's kind of like an extension of one of his personalities, you know, not to say that he's schizophrenic or anything like that,
but, right.
You know, it's like, yeah, that's that part of him that wants to be, you know, cool and hang out with the fellas and be the player and do all of that. Then you have where he writes for Vanity or Jill Jones. And that's kind of like his, you know, the more feminine side to his personality, you know, that I think through his work, he was just trying to balance it all out. But, you know, unlike a lot of people, he gets that platform where if he's not telling it through his art himself, then he's at, you know, he has all these other representatives or, I don't know, avatars like The Time or Jill Jones, Vanity Six, Sheila E., that he can also express what he's feeling, what he's thinking. But where it might come off a little different, him saying it himself, then he has these other representatives to get the point across for him.
Yep, exactly. And he, as you mentioned, he was really fortunate to have those creative outlets to do that. And so this is a ballad, a song sung from the perspective of a woman, written by a man about a man who is likely the person who wrote the song.
Right.
So it's really interesting when you think of it that way, and whether or not he did it consciously or subconsciously, you know, him writing a song about a man who's has a reputation of not really knowing how to truly give himself up to love, loves women, loves being with women, but then like monogamy again and faithfulness and having that spark, but always being there, that rock. That's why I go back to the whole Rolling Stone metaphor, because as we know through Prince's life and career, he was always moving, always on the move. Maybe not literally, because, you know, he had his place in Minneapolis, but ideas were fleeting. They would often, you know, be a great idea one day, and then a month later, he was like, oh, yeah, that, I'm done with that. I'm over it. And could that be sometimes translated to his personal relationships? Yeah, potentially, depends on who you ask. And maybe he saw some of that in himself, or else, like I said, if it was subconsciously, then he was definitely feeding into some of these lyrics through his own like idea of what a man who is alluring but also perplexing as well. The lines like, "You're like a drug, I can't get enough. You'd be great in motion pictures. You really got me blind. You're the only one I want to see, and you do it to me every time." This, again, just paints the picture that this person is really very, very much into the man that she's singing about. Like, she just has, she has it in a bad way for him, and she recognizes that she maybe is in a little bit over her head, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very poetic way of kind of putting that. You know, I kind of like that metaphor with the, you know, being, you know, great in motion pictures, because that's dealing with illusion. You know, you're dealing with actors, you know, especially like mindset of a, you know, Rudolph Valentino type that, you know, kind of has that magnetism with women that can, you know, they'll do anything for them.
Mm-hmm. It's like somebody that you want to see on the screen, right?
Right. And it's kind of like, oh, well, even though I know this is wrong, but I'm still going to go with that person, you know.
Yep. Somebody that you would pay money to go see a film with them starring.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of, again, speaks to the singer's level of attraction to this person.
Right. Yeah, and the you know, the drug, can't get enough of, yeah, that type of addiction, you know, they're, you know, what they call, like, I guess, maybe not necessarily toxic relationships all the time, but yeah, there are those moments, again, you know, when, especially when you're, that when it's on again, off again, you know, there's just something about that dynamic that, you know, your logic is overridden by the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, well, I know I shouldn't go back, but I'm gonna go back, and then it's fine for a while, then it crashes and burns again, and then again, so, you know, some cases, some people just want to keep going back, and mm-hmm. that was a perfect example of what their dynamic was, I think, up until, what, 89, 90, when I think she was kind of like, okay, I'm officially done. And
yeah, pretty much after Graffiti Bridge.
Yeah.
After her brief stint in the movie Graffiti Bridge. I do like also where in the line, "You really got me blind," but then in the very next line, "You're the only one I want to see." So it's like, is it just referencing a blindness for other people? Really, you know, just kind of like, what do you call it when you just have tunnel vision, where you mm-hmm. just can only see the one thing? So you're not really blind, but you're also ignoring everything else, you're the only, and everyone else, you're the only one I want to see. So obviously not, again, a literal blindness, but you got me blind to maybe other people, or blind to your faults. Like if somebody says I'm blind to this person's flaws, it's because they're so enamored with that person's, everything else about that person, that they can overlook some of the things that maybe would be red flags or flaws, like I mentioned, where other people can see them because they're not quite as into them as the person who can't see them. So it could be like a reference to that type of blindness as well. Anything else about this first verse before we move on to the chorus, Richard?
No, like I said, it's a, you know, damn good set of lyrics. Mm-hmm. Sure, you know, it's, I think, you know, that's among his best lyrically. You know, I know we focus on the music and arrangements, but a lot of times, you know, those lyrics, especially growing up listening to Prince, a lot of times it's, you know, those little phrases like that that stick with us, you know, kind of like a good film where, you know, we're constantly repeating the best lines in the film. You know, there's a lot of different Prince lyrics that, you know, 30, 40 years later, we're still... you know, reciting those, you know, chapter and verse sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Baby, you're an ocean that's too wide, too close. Baby, you're the cross that's too deep, too bare. Baby, So the chorus is, baby, you're an ocean that's too wide to cross. Baby, you're the cross that's too deep to bear. Baby, you're the star that's too far away. Baby, you're a trip and a half, but I don't care. So he starts off each one of these lines in the chorus with baby, which then, of course, the song is called Baby, You're a Trip, just like the last line. So these are, you know, he's using a lot of metaphors here again to kind of describe, you know, when she's singing it, to describe this person, this man that she's singing this song about. You're an ocean that's too wide to cross, a cross that's too deep to bear, which I was, I'm not entirely sure what that means. I don't know if it's supposed to be a take on a cross that's too heavy to bear, because that is typically what I hear when I'm, when people use the cross as a metaphor, a star that's too far away. So I don't know. I mean, you're a trip and a half, and that's the way it ends. So like this chorus feels like it's just a bunch of metaphors that he's using to describe this person and how unattainable they are. I don't know. Is that kind of what you're getting?
Maybe not unattainable, but it's that you, I don't know. Like I said, us, you know, being musicians back then, and like I said, really taking notice of the lyrics, and especially when we thought she wrote those lyrics. It was, to me, it was just like, that was the one we took notice of first. And it was where I'm thinking of it, like, it's like this amazement of, you know, whatever it is, the, you know, object of affection, or that's the one, and they do all these amazing things, or their personality is so dynamic, or the dynamic of the relationship is so, you know, up there, that it's like, wow, you know, you are that, you know, ocean is much too wide to cross. Like, man, that's, you know, that amazing that you can't cross it so easily. You know, the cross that's too deep to bear. Like,
it's like too deep in the ground, I wonder. I don't see, that's where I'm stuck on this metaphor. I don't really quite understand it, to be honest.
I think, I don't know if it's just creative license. Because I guess, fair. You know, heavy, yeah, I guess because heavy, it's that two syllables. I don't think it would have fit
in the range. I mean, you know, deep has the slang meaning, like, oh, man, that was really deep, you know, yeah, like really meaningful. So maybe that's what it means, too.
Yeah, double meaning of the word deep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, that's how I always felt.
Okay.
About that.
Yeah. Yeah, these metaphors always trip me up a little bit, because I wasn't sure if he was trying to say that this person is, you know, so unattainable, so difficult to grasp. Again, as I go back to that comment I made about the first verse, like, I want to kind of take hold of you and just show you how much I love you, but you're just too whatever, like,
yeah,
an ocean, you're just like an ocean that's too wide to cross, and a star is too far away. I can't get to you entirely to show you what you mean to me, but it doesn't matter because I don't care. Like, you're a trip and a half. Like, you're a crazy person. I love you. You're everything. I don't totally understand you, and I don't know if I ever will, but I don't care because I love it when we're together.
Right.
That's kind of always how I interpreted it a little bit, but I know that when you start using metaphors like this, it can be interpreted multiple ways. So I'm very interested in what other people have taken away from this chorus.
Yeah, like I said, great, great set of words.
Mm-hmm. It definitely makes you think, though. So because it is so interestingly written, it doesn't lay it all out there entirely without any kind of extra thought or open-ended meaning behind it, which again makes it interesting. I love what people think. They think I'm a star, such a little fool. But baby, you could be flat broke. I'd still be crazy for you. I know that I'm in love. So I changed my whole life just to make you smile. And I still can't have you. So the second verse, I know what people think. They think I'm a starstruck little fool. But baby, you could be flat broke. I'd still be crazy for you. And I know that I'm in love because I changed my whole life just to make you smile. And I still can't have you when I want. But when I do, it's only for a little while. Because... So the second verse is interesting. I'm going to let you start. See if you capture the same thoughts that I have.
Okay. I know it's weird. Like I said, you know, what were we like, 20, 21 when that came out? So like I said, you know, we're living, you know, just being that age. And on top of that, being musicians, and I know that year I also moved to California. So it was just all this, you know, like this adventurous time in life. And when you have a song like that, that's sort of, you know, always in the background, that's always there. It's also feeding your imagination, you know, because of, you know, you kind of have that sort of, you know, fantasy projection of someone that would say those things to you. You know, to find somebody that accepts you just for you, you know, at that age, was, you know, it, like I said, it was some moments, folks. It was some definite moments. But yeah, like I said, when you kind of have that music as your comfort and you hear lines like that and it's like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, her singing it, it always put me in mind of like Tina Marie records anyway, because I get that same feeling from like literally virtually every Tina Marie record. You know, in my head, every Tina Marie song is about me.
Nice.
But yeah, so I mean, as far as that verse, yeah, that's that. My memories of that, like I said, that I get that. Like, yeah, you want somebody, you accept them for who they are, not necessarily what other people think about them or, you know, how much money they have or, you know, what their status is. Now, the downside to that is those parts of that person's personality that, yeah, everyone else can see that they can be no good, but she doesn't care and accepts them for just who she is. So, you know, there's a positive and negative.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what makes this song what it is, really, because all the things that she's talking about, sometimes highlighting negatives, mostly highlighting positives, but at the end of the day, none of it matters. And that's why we get that last line of the chorus, baby, you're a trip and a half, but I don't care. Mm-hmm. And all of the lyrics leading up to that line are kind of explaining this person's perspective and stance on their relationship. So that way other people, they may have something to say about it. They may have, you know, like their opinions about this guy, some of them good, some of them not so good, but she's kind of like almost defending, in a way, defending her position again as, you know, a participant in this relationship, despite knowing and accepting their flaws. Going back to, again, the first verse, you know, somebody doesn't really know how to love is what other people say. I don't necessarily, she's saying, I don't necessarily agree with that, but this is what people say. And then the whole starstruck line in the second verse kind of points to, again, this is why it feels a little bit autobiographical, because from a, I don't know if power standpoint is the right word, but Prince was the artist. He was the one who was, you know, hiring and firing band members based off of their performance, based off of relationships. You know, he had the power. He was the creative energy too, and that came to a relationship, and he was the primary force of that. So, like, to say I'm starstruck kind of puts her a little bit in more of a submissive role, where she's almost looking at him as idol worship in some ways. And then he wrote that for her to sing about him. In 1982, this is also when Prince was just starting to, you know, have inklings of a very successful career. You know, Controversy was the previous album, was every single subsequent album kind of puts him up a little bit higher on the pop culture pedestal. And the 1999 album would go even above and beyond that by quite a bit. So, hey, like, are you going to love me if this fails? Like, I don't think he ever thought that he was going to fail at music. But I also wonder if sometimes he wanted to make sure that potential, lovers, girlfriends, whatever you want to call them, accepted him for who he was. And a line like, baby, you could be flat broke and I'd still be crazy for you, is maybe him projecting on that a little bit. Like, I want to make sure that you're not just in it because I'm, you know, a potential superstar. You know, I have some money, I have some fame, and I plan on being even bigger, but would you be here for me regardless? So,
right. Yeah. Which Jason, yeah, that speaks again, you know, to what we do know of his background, you know, growing up, you know, like I said, coming from a broken home. You know, he didn't always have money in his pocket. And, you know, if you're going through high school, you know, that's a big deal, you know, having enough money to go out on a date, you know, that's among your top two concerns, you know, as a teenager, you know, having money to go out, or just having money, period.
Period. And, yeah.
You know, and given his dynamic, like with his height and everything, even though he had girlfriends in high school, you know, I can see that, you know, because we all went through that in high school, where, you know, that level of competition, because you're competing with the actual jocks, or you're competing with whoever's considered the most popular. And, you know, you're trying to figure out how you can get noticed, you know, without making a fool of yourself. And I can see, you know, that difference between high school and then catapulted into, you know, superstardom, then, yeah, that dynamic changes. So it stops being about, well, okay, yeah, Prince is okay, but, you know, the quarterback of the football team, or the, you know, the school president, or, you know, this person, you know, with the looks or whatever.
With the money, yeah.
Right, and the money. So now you're the superstar. So that's all that women see. It's like, oh, that's the superstar. And they go running towards that superstar because he's got the fame, he's got the money, the, you know, the status, and they want to be a part of that. So, yeah, that begs the question in the lyrics. Yeah, are you seeing me for me, or is it because of the fame and the fortune? And so, yeah, like that question, and, you know, you could be flat broke, then that's either him projecting an image from the past, or a question he was wrestling with when he was writing the song. And then probably with her singing it, it kind of does take on a different dynamic. I don't know if we'll get into the Prince version later, but yeah, I think that, yeah, with her singing it, that line carries a different weight. Because it's a different dynamic with that whole thing of, it doesn't matter if that person's, you know, the outsider or the superstar, it's, you know, what her friends or her family projects onto that image, whether it's true or not, versus her being so caught up in love with that person, versus, you know, the way Prince would sing it, or the way Prince was writing it, it's him asking these internal questions about, you know, when I was broke, no one was looking at me, but now that I'm somebody, would it still matter? You know, do you still see me for me?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And honestly, the two versions are virtually identical from a lyrical standpoint.
Right.
The only difference is who's singing it. There's one word that he changes. Instead of says girl in his version, and then she says child. Otherwise, the lyrics are identical. So I take it, again, I know the Prince version, he's singing it, but I've always, even when I listen to the Prince version, like, this is Jill's song. Like, I don't think of it as one of those songs that could be switched from, you know, the gender switch. Like, I don't see him giving this song to a man to sing.
Oh, no. It definitely would have been, if Jill Jones wasn't singing it, he would have, you know, like, if this was on 1999, I don't know. I remember talking to somebody who's saying, oh, yeah, when did the episode on originals, that I always felt like this was a song that if he did keep that to himself, yeah, this would have been like around 82, 83. This would have been a really strong ballad. And the arrangement of it, and this was kind of like at the beginning of when R&B was kind of really, in a way, returning to the church with the gospel arrangements. I think if he had polished that song and kept it to himself, that would have been one of those early, you know, kind of like, you know, things that like Stephanie Mills was doing with her ballads in the 80s at that point. I'm drawing a blank on some other, but there were a lot of songs, you know, ballads that were kind of, the lyrics were secular, but the arrangements were purely rooted in church with that. And I think that had he kept it to himself, that would have been definitely one of those strong contenders.
Okay. I agree with you. And it's just so, but it's so weird for me to think of him keeping this song for himself, because the lyrics are so, they feel so autobiographical to me. So for him to be singing this song himself would feel really strange.
Strange. For then, yeah, definitely for then. And probably the reason why he kept it, because I don't know, I haven't really lyrically listened to, you know, a lot of the early stuff in a long time, but
I mean, can you hear Prince singing a line like, they think I'm a starstruck little fool, and him singing it genuinely himself about some woman? I mean, I guess maybe, but
well, yeah,
it's hard maybe, for me.
Yeah, in night. Well, that's the thing. It's because I was going to say, yeah, we hadn't gotten to When Doves Cry yet at that stage. So yeah, as far as 1999 era, 1982 era Prince, I don't think, like I said, probably one of the reasons that song stayed in the vault, and then the great idea was to give it to Jill Jones to sing. But I think the better song, if it, you know, I don't, they're two different songs, but I think lyrically, Something in the Water was a better song for Prince to kind of voice those concerns about himself or open himself up. That was probably the most open with that song. Where,
yes,
yeah, I could probably see maybe an older Prince tackling Baby Your Trip, you know, had he kept it to himself.
Yeah. It's just an interesting song for me, because again, he was playing around a little bit with, you know, him being a little bit more submissive in a relationship, or, you know, at this time. You have songs like When You Were Mine from Dirty Mind, where he's clearly starstruck, if you were going to use that term loosely, enough to let this woman walk all over him in many cases. Something in the Water, as you already cited, which was written around the same time and would end up on 1999, is about how he lets her treat him so badly. Why You Wanna Treat Me So Bad, off the second album. Automatic has a lot of aspects of submissiveness and accepting his role in the relationship, where there's a very powerful a woman that he's into in a big way. So I guess I'm kind of almost talking myself out of my thoughts that this would sound weird being sung by Prince, because I know that he's singing, I feel like, I don't know this because I didn't know him and I don't know where his mind was at when he wrote it,
right? But
it feels like he's writing it about himself, or another woman to sing about him. But that doesn't mean that he could not flip it and make it much more about, you know, this overpoweringly beautiful and charismatic woman that he can't seem to shake, because he's sung songs like that before. So it wouldn't be that big of a stretch I just have a hard time because I know this as a Jill Jones song. So it's so difficult for me.
I know. Like I said, I've only heard this version because we had the original's version. You said it was 2019.
Yeah.
So officially. Yeah, I would have had the bootleg maybe probably about four years prior to that. For me, when I listened to the Prince version of it, like you said, it's near complete, but I felt like a lot of Prince stuff that's in the vault, it's either one vocal take or a few overdubs of something complete, you know, short of being complete. Like, yeah, you could put this on the album. Now, that being said, it's still better than, you know, 80% of everybody else's demos, you know, that are in circulation. But yeah, the lyric, while he had the complete set of lyrics, to me, when I listen to the vocal performance, there are these flashes of where, yeah, you could release it now. And then there's some, like, I think if he had gone back to say, okay, I'm going to finish this, this is going on this album, or it's going to be the first single or second single to something, I think he would have gone back in and done a stronger vocal take on it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's not slighting anybody that loves that version of it. I love that version of it as well. But I think the difference when I listen to it, like I said, I hear more of how great the instruments sound, because you don't have like the orchestral overdubs on that. Mm-hmm. But Jill's version, and this is for me, what I think is the hallmark of a great singer. And this is something that's definitely lost in today's music, probably across the board, even some segments of country music, where singers have forgotten how to sell a song. And I think that was the strength of the Jill Jones version, because you do have the orchestral overdubs, but that song is structured to where you focus on her voice and how she interprets the lines versus how Prince originally recorded. So I think that stands out the most.
Yeah. Yeah, the arrangement in the Prince version is very simple, and then we get such a much more lush sounding version for Jill's album. So it just adds a lot more dynamic emotion attached to it. Like, you have like this big swelling of orchestra strings, and it's almost, again, like a motion picture, child. So like she says in the song.
Oh yeah, that album is very cinematic.
Cinematic, that's a great word. Before we move on, the only other thing I want to talk about with second verse is that towards the end, when he/she says, "I still can't have you when I want, but when I do, it's only for a little while." To me, this is where I was pointing back to the singer kind of acknowledging and almost accepting, begrudgingly maybe, but accepting that he's not monogamous. But I guess it can also be interpreted that he's just gone a lot. Like, maybe he's just not there because he's traveling for, you know, on tour, or always going someplace to record music or whatever. I guess you could interpret it that way, but I've always interpreted it as him like having more than one person in his life, more than one girlfriend, more than one significant other. I can't have you when I want, because sometimes it's her night to have you. I don't know. Do you have an opinion on that? How have you thought of that?
Jason, when it comes to Prince, sometimes you have to check that box that says all of the above.
Yeah, because he probably just says, like, I'm not coming over tonight, and you don't need to know why. And so then it's left up to her and, you know, in the song to think, okay, was it because he's got something to do? Is it because he's got another girlfriend to see? Is it because he's leaving town for a while? Like, I only get to see you for a little while. And she's, you know, that just is what it is.
You know, like you said, we don't know Prince. We weren't there, you know, whether he was on the phone with, say, Jill or Vanity or whoever. But I almost don't see him as that that type of player that's like, yeah, I can't make it. I got a cold tonight. just due to the fact that one of the facts we do have is that when it came to the 1999 tour, and you know, Vanity was on the bus with Prince, and you know, whoever Jill and Kim and this person and Susan were on another bus. There's no hiding it at that point. You know, there's no you know, there's no excuses at that point. That's why I say with Prince, I think sometimes you have to check the box that says all of the above. So yeah, I think part of it is that, and it's weird you kind of have that overlap, because if he's self-aware of it, she was definitely aware of it.
Yes.
Yeah. So it, again, you know, when you listen to both versions back to back, you know, both theories could be true. It's the thing of, yeah, he was definitely either on tour. There were times when, yeah, he was on tour and she was like living in New York or something. Yeah. And the, you know, the responsibilities of the music business took precedent. And then there were times, yeah, he was in the middle of recording an album at Sunset Sound and she was, you know, wherever she was. And again, it goes back to the tour bus too.
And there was times where he was with somebody else. Okay. Well, I just wanted to bring that up because I thought it's an interesting way to end that verse.
Yeah.
So then we get the chorus again, which is the same. Baby, you're an ocean that's too wide to cross. Baby, you're the cross that's too deep to bear. Baby, you're the star that's too far away. Baby, you're a trip and a half, but I don't care. Bridge, you see it's in my diet, something in the water don't compute. Baby, I'm quite happy after you give me love, and you see, and you can see who's the fool, you. So we got your reference to something in the water, which definitely dates this song back to 1982, even when it was released in 87, a very clear reference to its timeline. It just, you know, the after you give me some love, you can see who's the fool, you. So she's calling him out as the fool, or he's calling her out as the fool, depending on which version you're listening to. So I don't know how to take that, and like if her, he, or if they're just saying like, I'm good for you, I'm good with you when we're together. After you give me love, you can see who's the fool, you, because maybe you should be the one that wants to stay with me. Like, I'm good for you, and you're the fool for then taking off and, you know, leaving me here again alone. Just one interpretation, I guess.
Yeah, I, you know, I don't know. I haven't really given the bridge of it much thought, because of the strength of the chorus and the first two verses. Those are the things that have always stood out to me on that song. Those are like the strongest parts of the song. You know, as far as pure songwriting, yeah, you know, the best songwriters know how to resolve it. Even if it's not the strongest part of the song, it's still like, okay, this is bringing this song home. It's bringing it to an end. You know, it doesn't leave it open. So yeah, I never I never had any real personal thoughts beyond the, you know, I like the reference to something in the water doesn't compute. I like that reference quite a bit. Like I said, number one, it calls back to that original song, kind of keeps it in that purple world a little bit. But again, given that subject matter of that song along with these lyrics in this one, yeah, you know, again, that seemed to have been a running theme in Prince's songs in that early period. you know, where, like I said, a lot of that, it's him kind of resolving, I would say, you know, adolescence or the high school years and those insecurities, you know, that kind of fed all of those albums up to Purple Rain. And then post Purple Rain, then you get this kind of slowly maturing Prince to where you don't really get a lot of those insecurities. There's a little bit more confidence. There's a little bit more maturity with the actual love songs post Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say even like with the Beautiful Ones, it's like that kind of just really, to me, I would think, as I'm talking about it now, got it out of his system. So there were no more songs about high school insecurities anymore. This is like, okay, I'm an adult and I'm a superstar. Now I'm dealing with whatever comes with that. So it's not the teenage insecurities. It's now dealing with adult situations now.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good observation. It really was kind of a switch that got flipped in his songwriting, or ballad songwriting at least. This ballad just felt more mature after From Purple Rain on, in many cases. Sometimes he would get silly with some of the sex related ballads, but the ones that were more about heartbreak or dealing with a difficult relationship or difficult emotions around a relationship, they were done quite maturely. So I'm with you on that. I sense it too and feel it when I'm listening to his music chronologically. The rest of the song is pretty much the same lyrics that we've already been hearing. Extended version of Prince and or Jill singing song lines around the chorus again and just doing a lot of ad-libbing, but most of it is just staying within the context of the lines that have already been said. And then you've got that a cappella portion at the end, which kind of combines the first verse and the chorus. Oh Lord, I know those people say that you don't know how to love, but I want you, baby. You're like a drug, I just can't get enough. You'd be great in motion pictures, girl. And that's where he says girl, but she says child. Because you really got me blind. You'd be the only one I want to see, only one that done it to me every time. I do the do with you. You're like an ocean, which is a very, do the do is a very time. Whenever I hear him say do the do, I always just think of the time and something Morris Day says in time songs. Mm-hmm. So to hear Jill say, I do the do with you, it's kind of silly to me. It's just a very Prince way of saying have sex.
I've always thought it was I didn't realize that was a lyric.
Yeah.
the way
that they say it, Prince and Jill says it, it's sung very quickly. So unless you're really paying attention, you don't really notice it. She's got to get through those, or he or she, I keep saying Jill, because again, this is Jill's song, and I don't know why I can't get it in my head that it's also a Prince song, and mainly a Prince song that he gave to Jill. Anyway, I do the do with you. It's not a line that is very clear and sung with the purpose of being well understood. You have to have the lyrics in front of you, I think, to really get it.
Yeah.
But I can't think of that line without thinking of like something that Morris Day would say.
I know. I thought she was being soulful.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I thought that was a vocal ad lib or, you know, a little scat thing. I didn't realize that now I have to go back and listen to it now.
Yeah, do. Definitely do. Listen to that a cappella section.
Yeah. Can't sing it like do do do. I just keep hearing it as a vocal, like a vocal.
Yeah. Yep. That's what it sounds like too. You sang it just like it sounds. You're like an ocean that's much too wide to cross. You're the cross that's much too deep to bear. You are the star much too far away, but I don't care. You're a trip and a half, and I want you every day. Hey! And that's how the song ends. And the album. That's how the song and the album.
Yep.
But if you're just listening to originals, that's how the song ends. So, I don't have anything additional to say about any of those lyrics that are used in the a cappella, because it's basically a regurgitation or, you know, recycling of the first verse and chorus. So I don't have anything additional around that, just like the performance You know, I really like how it's done a cappella style at the end.
Yeah, I, you know, that's, I think, one of her strengths as well as a vocalist, because I think she was so, you know, probably one of the few of the Prince girlfriends that were so in tune with him. Yeah, no pun intended, but, you know, just so in tune with him that she was able to take his guide vocals. And she was such a good imitator of his voice. She was literally the female equivalent. You know, they say Vanity was on a certain level, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. But vocally, I think that Jill was able to be that sort of female version of Prince on those songs, to where, okay, well, yeah, he's going to scream here. She could scream just as well as he could. You know, the little James Brown, hey, at the end.
Hey!
You know, it shows just how, you know, just how down to earth she was, that she can, you know, have that confidence to step to the mic and do that just as well as Prince could do that on the record.
So, yeah, it's a bummer. This version, her version, the official release version, is not available on YouTube even. So, I mean, yeah, it's not streamed. But it's been scrubbed clean. Like, anybody would ever uploaded a video of Baby Your Trip from Jill Jones album, it's been removed. It's been flagged and removed.
I wonder if it's the Prince estate, because the original's version.
That's the only excuse I can think of.
Because
the rest of the album you could find, you just can't find Baby Your Trip.
Yeah, I think I was, like I said, I just have the cassette. Never had the CD, never had the vinyl. But I was able to get those versions at the time when you could get that available, and sort of made my own little deluxe version of it.
Yeah.
So I guess I must have been lucky to get that. Let's see. Yeah, that's probably a couple of years before originals came out. So yeah, that makes sense. So I was able to get it before they took it down now, which is a shame, you know. Hopefully,
it's a shame this album isn't streaming, period. Not officially.
No, you know, a lot of it, the, you know, Madhouse, the family. I think somebody may have been lucky enough to sneak Mavis Staples, the first Paisley Park album. Time Waits for No One, that one. What else have I seen? I've seen St. Paul's first one, even though Prince had nothing to do with that one, but St. Paul's first one. So I don't know if that was MCA officially releasing it on streaming now, or if somebody was lucky enough to sneak it onto the streaming services. But a lot of those albums, and especially the Jill Jones album, that deserves a reissue.
Agreed. All right, well, that's Baby, You're a Trip, Richard. Not much else to say. It's a great song if you can find it, if you can find a way to listen to it. I've got the album on vinyl, but it's not like vinyl's a really convenient method to listen to songs, because it's not. It's nice when I'm in my office or in my home, but if I'm out and about and I want to listen to this song, Jill's version, kind of out of luck.
Like I said, unless you got a digital converter, you can convert it to MP3 and take it with you.
Let's just hope someday that gets resolved and then I don't have to really worry about it anymore.
Yeah.
But we have the Prince version, which is obviously very good.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're drastically different songs, because they're not. Really, the only difference is the vocalist and the orchestral strings added to Jill's version, which are nice. I'm not going to deny it. It's nice. Nice addition, but Prince's version's great. So it's fine.
Yeah. Like I said, I enjoy listening to it. Like I said, it's a vocal overdub away from to where you could put it on an official album, but for what it is, it's still brilliant and everything is still there, you know. So you can listen to that and just, you know, if you can go listen to the rest of the Jill Jones album just to get a feel for how her voice sounds, you know, just listen to the Prince version and just kind of imagine you know, Jill putting her spin on it and imagine what it would sound like. I know that's sad, but until we get an official release version.
Yeah, there's at least one, maybe two versions on YouTube of Jill performing the song live.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, so go check that out.
And they're really good. They're really good. So definitely check those out if you're not familiar with Jill's official version. You can't find it streaming. Just go watch her do it live. It's great.
Yeah.
It's very, very close to what you would get off the album anyway.
Right.
All right, our Mari Communications. So why don't you talk, Richard, a little bit about what you got going on there and with your music career?
All right. So I've got Mari Communications, the channel, which you can find on YouTube. There's Mari Music Talk. Mostly talks about Prince, but I also talk about other things, whether it's Cameo, Tony. There's even some Beatles content you can watch on that channel. So like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. As far as music, Funky Poetic Bootlegs, that is my four-track cassette, avant-garde project, album, whatever you want to call it, that is available on most streaming platforms. And it's also on my website, richardcolemusic.com. And working on some new music and working on some other projects as well.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. And thank you for joining me on this episode, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, Jason, it's been a long time. I'm glad to be back.
Yes, glad to have you back, as always. This has been the Press Rewind Prince Lyrics Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Brenninger, and you can find the show also on YouTube, but as well as X, / Twitter, Facebook, yeah. Instagram, Threads. But PressRewind.net is the website where I host all my episodes. If you want to just go there, you can find them all. Just do a little search and find them on your basically any other podcast catcher that you've got out there that you use. And until next time, thank you very much and goodbye.
I know those people say, they say you don't know how to love, but I want you anyway, baby, you're like a drug. I can't get enough, cause you be great in motion pictures, girl. You really got me blind. You'd be the only one I won't see, only one I do it every time. All I do is you. Much too hard to cross. You are the cross that's much too deep to bear.